Morena koutou, he te whānau. Lovely to be here in front of you today. Mother's Day today, it's a fitting day to have some imagery and some language of God as a mother as part of our service. Had a passage there about God is giving birth to us, and one that had an image of God as a mother hen. But it is worth acknowledging as well that mothers aren't the only people who can be a nurturing, caring caregiver in the life of a child. Just like that imagery that Barbara brought to us last week of a shepherd caring for their sheep, this nurturing parental language and imagery for God can be a great comfort for us and can give us security in our identities as beloved children of God. But I'm aware that not everybody feels this way. In my role as a chaplain, I often come across people who might say that they have a faith or that they're from a church background, but in their times of distress, when they are struggling with things in their lives, when they're struggling with their mental well-being, the last thing they want to talk about is God and faith. That doesn't bring them a sense of comfort. And in fact, for some people, there is stress that's associated with God and with faith. So I really think it's worth exploring why this might be. And this might be an experience that some of us here have. I know that, you know, whatever's taught in our church, that we're all influenced by lots of teaching from lots of places and from our background. So this is really worth delving into. And my source for most of what I'm talking about this morning is a therapist and writer called Crispin Mayfield. So he's written this book that I can recommend, and I'll tell you a bit more about later. But humans are made for connection, right? We can see this especially with young children and the need that young children have for a secure, nurturing caregiver. You know, it's this closeness with a caregiver that gives them a sense of comfort. It gives them security in their own identity and a healthy sense of self. They know that they'll be provided for. They know that they'll be safe. And it equips them to go into adulthood with confidence as well. But humans, parents are human. You know, children need somebody who is present both emotionally and physically. But as parents, it's usually not possible for us to be consistently there for children. And we all come into this with our own struggles, our own issues, our own needs, our own things going on. So there are times when we won't be physically there, and there are times that, you know, those of us who are parents can't be emotionally engaged at all the time. And there's this whole field of science called attachment science that looks at the strategies that children use to try and get that closeness if they don't feel like they can rely on it from their parents, which is really interesting to look at. But what's also interesting is how sometimes we can use those same sort of strategies to try and feel close to God. And although these might be strategies that we could have learnt in our own childhoods, with our own interactions with our parents, or they might have come out of things that we've been taught in churches about the kind of parent that God is, and they can be helpful strategies for children, but overall, as we look at them, we'll see that they don't really contribute to our well-being. They don't really help us to have that secure base and that secure sense of identity. So let's go through and just look at these one by one. What does a toddler do if they're scared or upset or anxious and they want their caregiver close? Yeah, cry, reach out, make these moves to try and get that connection. But if they don't get that response consistently, if they don't know that they can just call out and have that closeness and have that comfort, then they learn how to find ways to try and keep that. You know, there's that fear that if their parent isn't always engaged with them, if their parent's attention is somewhere else, if their parent might be going away somewhere, that they don't know that they'll return, or they don't know that they can get that back. So that can become a preoccupation. You know, it can become something that they're thinking about all the time. And you see this in some children's behaviour. It's absolutely understandable. You know, getting really upset when their parents concentrating on, or their caregivers concentrating on something else. You know, clinging to a little boy, clinging to his mother's skirt, not wanting her to go away, not wanting to go off and play on the playground by himself. See, if this is a strategy that we've needed to use over and over again, then we learn, you know, even maybe into adulthood, that we have to be constantly working hard to keep the people that we need close. Staying vigilant, looking for any cracks in the relationship. And there's this underlying fear that if we don't keep on doing these things, we might be abandoned. And we call this way of relating anxious attachment. So the imagery here is of holding a helium balloon, and you know, if your attention is away from it for a moment, it might slip out of your hands and just float away. But what does that mean for the way that we connect with God? You know, we've been taught all sorts of things about what it looks like to live in a way that's faithful to God. Right, and that might look different depending on the kind of traditions that we've come from. But anxious spirituality describes the worry that some of us have that if we don't keep up doing all of those things, then we might backslide, drift away, lose our faith. Are these kind of terms that you're familiar with? Yeah. So this sense that it's up to us to keep God close, maybe making sure we don't miss a devotional time, that we're consistently living out our values in community, or that we're singing our worship songs in the most heartfelt way. And those are all good things to do, absolutely. They can be exhausting. They might not be things that we can keep up consistently in all seasons of our life. Then we might feel really close to God when we're doing those things. But if that has this underlying anxiety that if we don't keep it up, then we could fall away, then God won't stay close to us. It doesn't allow us to have that peaceful rest that comes from secure connection. So for an example of how this can sort of become ingrained in some Christian teaching, I have a quote from the theologian Charles Spurgeon 150 years ago. "The Christian life is very much like climbing a hill of ice. You cannot slide up. Nay, you have to cut every step with an ice axe. Only incessant labor in cutting and chipping can you make any progress. If you want to know how to backslide, leave off going forward. Cease going upward. And you'll go downward of necessity. You can never stand still." Does that sound like the kind of connection with a secure, nurturing, loving parent that we hope to find in God? Let's look at the next one. So maybe to you, relying on how close we feel to God sounds a little bit ridiculous. I don't know. It's a really understandable way to see things, especially as we look at this next strategy. Some of us have learned through the experiences of our lives that when we expressed emotion like anger or sadness, difficult emotions, that instead of drawing the people that we needed close, that it pushed them away. You know, it might have been an explicit message from parents like, "Harden up. You know, no place for tears here." Or it might have been something subconsciously absorbed, like a parent being clearly uncomfortable when you're crying and upset and trying to soothe it very quickly. Either way, the lessons that some children learn is that everything goes better in relationships if we keep those feelings to ourselves, we push them aside, we do what we need to do to just keep on moving forward. Maybe something like a house with those emotions locked in the basement. And if we get really well practiced at locking those emotions up, locking those difficult feelings up, sometimes we don't even notice that they're there anymore. Sometimes when people ask us how we're doing, how we're feeling, we're not really even sure ourselves. And if this is the strategy that we've learned in other relationships, it's that our uncomfortable emotions aren't welcome. It makes sense that fear and anger and sadness aren't compatible with a life of faith. I mean, if the fruit of the Spirit are love, joy, and peace, then surely God wouldn't want us dwelling on anything else. But just because we've locked up those feelings in the basement, it doesn't mean that they're not there. Emotions help us to connect with other people, help us to understand what other people might be experiencing. They help us understand what's important to us as well and what we need. Shutting down parts of ourselves doesn't really allow us to thrive. I've got another Charles Spurgeon quote here, which is a bit of a doozy. There's nothing so deluded as feelings. Christians cannot live by feelings. Let me further tell you that many feelings are the work of Satan, for they are not right feelings. What right have you to set up your feelings against the word of Christ? You might not have heard anything quite that blatant, but you know, are you familiar with those sorts of messages sometimes underlying things? Yeah. We'll look at the last strategy for attachment. Some children grow up for feeling, for all sorts of reasons, like their parents don't really like them. Like there must be something inherently unlovable about themselves. We know that even children who are treated really awfully by their parents, you know, even children who are afraid of their parents, often still long for connection with them. So, the strategy that they learn to try and keep that connection is to blame themselves for the way that they're treated. To believe that somehow it's their own fault. And this is what we call shame-filled attachment. And the approach here is uncomfortably similar to the teaching we hear sometimes about how God sees us. Even think of a line in a song that we sang a couple of weeks back. Not because of who I am, but because of who you are. You know, maybe to most of us that just passes over our head, but I know that, you know, for people who, you know, this is part of how they're identifying themselves, that can speak into that part. You know, does God predominantly see me as a sinner unworthy of love, only able to enter God's presence because Jesus took the punishment that I deserved? If our fear is that we'll be eternally punished if we don't choose to stay in relationship, then to be close to God is to be continually reminding ourselves of how undeserving we are of God's love and mercy. And just like these other attachment strategies, it can never really give us a healthy sense of identity that a child gets from closeness with a nurturing caregiver who they know they're beloved by. So what do we do with this? What do we do with these teachings that we might have been given or that might come up or that we might, you know, hear in some kind of way that point towards these kinds of ways of relating to God? You know, when the science shows us that this kind of relationship brings us harm instead of healing, what do we do when we read a passage of Scripture and it sounds to us like it's something that brings us more anxiety or causes us to shut down parts of ourselves or that fills us with shame. So let's look at Jesus for an example and see how he dealt with scripture that had been understood in a way that brought more harm than healing. I'll read you out a passage here. Now, Jesus was teaching in one of the synagogues on the Sabbath. Just then, there appeared a woman with a spirit that had crippled her for 18 years. She was bent over and was quite unable to stand up straight. When Jesus saw her, he called her over and said, "Woman, you are set free from your ailment." When he laid his hands on her, immediately she stood up straight and began praising God. But the leader of the synagogue, indignant because Jesus had cured on the Sabbath, kept saying to the crowd, "There are 6 days on which work ought to be done. Come on those days and be cured, and not on the Sabbath day." But the Lord answered him and said, "You hypocrites! Does not each of you on the Sabbath untie his ox or his donkey from the manger and lead it to water? And ought not this woman, a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan bound for 18 long years, be set free from this bondage on the Sabbath day?" When he said this, all his opponents were put to shame, and the entire crowd was rejoicing at the wonderful things being done by him. So the discussion here is about the Sabbath, the Jewish law, scriptural teachings about what it looks like to live faithfully to God, say that the Sabbath is a day of rest. And Jesus is Jewish. He knows this law. And he knows that, you know, if he chooses not to do something that's deemed as work, apparently like healing someone, then that would show that he is an upright and faithful man. So it's not really surprising that this synagogue leader, you know, interrupted this holy moment, this moment where this woman is praising God because she's standing upright for the first time in 18 years. Because people generally saw physical ailments as being somehow punishments from God, even having her in the synagogue probably would have been looked down upon. So surely Jesus could have waited just one more day before healing this woman. I mean, the scriptures on it are pretty clear, right? But what does Jesus point out? Even the most upright, faithful people still go out and look after their animals on the Sabbath. If the way they're interpreting the law means this woman can't have healing and restoration today, they need to look again at how they're understanding this. There must be another way of understanding the scriptural teachings. And there's a further explanation from Jesus on how he's looking at this passage. In the Gospel of Mark, a similar sort of situation with a religious leader questioning Jesus, and he says to them, "The Sabbath was made for humankind, not humankind for the Sabbath." If the way that we're understanding the teachings isn't contributing to people's healing and restoration, if it's causing harm, there must be another way to understand it and to apply it. So in conclusion, first, I want to recommend this book to you. Andrew's bought this copy for the church library, so it'll be available for you to borrow. And Crispin has much more detail on each of these ways of approaching connection with God, and also a lot of really good advice in there for finding different ways to feel connected with God that can be healthier. So, highly recommend. But mostly, I want us to approach theology with curiosity, you know, to notice things that come up, to discuss them, to question these sorts of things, to look at whether there are other ways to understand things, whether other communities are looking at this differently, and especially communities that are sort of on the margins, that are where people have you know, an even bigger need to have a loving, nurturing God. Let's see if there are more helpful ways to understand some of these things. And then finally, it might be helpful to leave you with the image of God as a mother for you, welcoming you with outstretched arms, inviting you to tell her about what's been going on, to rest your head on her chest, to let the tears flow if you need, and to know that you'll always be her beloved child.